You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen Farmer with you and introducing the topic of empathy today. What does that look like in the classroom? How is it taught in UAE schools? We spoke to two educators and it was Dr. Chris Willard, Harvard medical faculty member, author, psychologist and dad, who was sharing his take and his strategies on teaching and fostering empathy in our kids.
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Ranches Primary School, a nurturing community school and nursery committed to holistic education in the heart of Arabian Ranches too.
I actually feel like empathy is a really important topic at any time, but it feels particularly pertinent. And joining us from the States is Dr. Chris Willard, a prominent figure in the field. He is from Harvard Medical School faculty member, a psychologist, a consultant. His expertise spans anxiety, mindfulness, meditation. He's the author of 20 books, including Alpha Breaths, Growing Up Mindful, How We Grow Through What We Go Through, and the upcoming, brilliantly named, Feelings Are Like Farts. I'm so honoured to have you, Chris. last time we spoke, you said this book was going to be coming soon, and I've been waiting for its release, pun fully intended. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you? It's so nice to reconnect. And I also want to say congratulations to you. I understand you had a book just come out a week or two ago.
It's doing really, really well. It's doing really well. I'm thrilled, if a little bit overwhelmed, to be completely brutal. But we'd talked about this as a topic a while ago. And I just want to give you a little kind of insight into what's happening in Dubai right now. So for most people listening, they are either working from home or they might be in the cars, because we've had some unstable weather, which meant that the children are out of school and they are at home doing distance learning on Zoom, on Teams, on an awful app called Seesaw, which, if you don't know it, you are blessed.
Oh, I remember Seesaw.
Oh, it's horrendous. And I think empathy towards ourselves and empathy towards our children at this time is absolutely on the nose. So I'm really glad we're talking about this. With your expertise on, as I said, with anxiety, mindfulness, meditation and empathy today, what are your hopes that listeners will get from this next hour? What are we looking to share with them?
Well, I hope that we can, you know, kind of come away from this with practical strategies for how to cultivate more empathy in yourself, cultivate more empathy in your kids. And I think, you know, one thing I've heard in recent years is people saying, you know, a lot of us want our kids to grow up to be great people. And then I was saying, you know what, actually, I just want my kid to grow up to be a good person, to be a good adult, to be happy, to be kind, to be empathic and caring. And I think, you know, that to me is, I think, what we really want when we slow down and actually think about it. But it's our fear that gets in the way. They need to be achieving this and achieving that, when really kind, empathic, that's probably what we actually really do want for our kids as they turn into adults.
Couldn't agree more. Before we get to the topic of the day, you have spoken in more than 30 countries, you know, you're in the States right now. What are you noticing in terms of patterns and trends around children's mental health? You know, what are the psychologists talking about, Doctor?
Oof. Well, as you're probably aware, it's not good out there. what we're seeing is a massive uptick in anxiety. We're also seeing more depression. We're seeing, I think, a lot of people are worried, oh my gosh, you know, is there more, self-harm and suicide? There's actually not that big of a rise in that. But we're worried about our kids. They're not getting to school. They're not as motivated. Anxiety is a really big thing. And then the other thing that's interesting is we're seeing actually a bit of a drop in, some other behaviors that we might have worried about in the past. So there's good news and there's bad news. It's just, it's mixed, unfortunately. And but I'd say anxiety and depression are really leading the pack, and other issues like that.
You know, I want to know why. And I think we can put a big finger towards, you know, the pandemic in the UK. Certainly we've seen an awful lot of, you know, children's mental health, you know, fallout from that, when, you know, routines were so disruptive. You know, the UK in particular had a very extended lockdown periods and education disruption as well. We didn't have it to the same extent by any means here in the UAE, but yet we are still seeing rise in anxiety, in particular in children here. Can we say why? Is it useful to kind of draw direct lines and correlations between children's mental health being in crisis and cause?
I think it is useful because, you know, looking at the whys give us something of a solution. And I think there's a few different ways we can look at the whys here. For example, I'm a believer, this is going to be a fancy sounding word, the biopsychosocial model, which basically means, you know, our bodies and genetics, you know, are part of it here, right? How much sleep we're getting, how's our, you know, exercise, health, body, sleep, things like that. And then the psychological, which is kind of how we perceive the world, right? Some people perceive it just with a little more danger, kind of wired for a little bit more of that than other people. And then lastly, the social, which is sort of like childhood experiences. Have you been through any traumas? You know, what were your parents like? Cultural experiences that play into this as well. So we put those three together, and that to me is what creates either mental health or mental illness and kind of more problems. And then I think we can dig down a little bit deeper. And there's been a lot of talk recently. You know, you certainly mentioned the pandemic, the isolation of the pandemic. You know, there's this sort of the anxiety treatment. The joke and the truth of it is like exposure therapy, right? Get out there and do it. You know, put yourself. You know, you have to jump in the pit of snakes like Indiana Jones, but you know, you kind of expose yourself to your fears. And one of the things the pandemic did is it didn't give anybody any practice with being in school, meeting new people, being in uncomfortable situations besides being stuck at home, of course, right? And so kids didn't get some of those experiences. So that's why social anxiety is on the rise. And then the other piece, I believe, is social media. And I don't want to throw all social media under the bus and say it's all bad, but we know that the rates of anxiety really went up, you know, around the time that the iPhone came out and kids started getting cell phones and smartphones.
Dr. Chris, I know I should know the answer to this, but are you a dad yourself? I feel like we talked about parenthood last time we spoke.
I am indeed. You may hear my kids screaming in the background. I've got a 9-year-old and my 6-year-old's not up. That's going to be an ugly scene, but my 9-year-old's hanging out in the next room.
We were talking just last week about screen-free childhood, and actually with an education consultant and a doctor around the impact of screen time on the developing brain. What decisions are you going to take as a father, you know, given your knowledge as a psychologist, you know, especially around anxiety and mindfulness? Have you thought that far ahead yet with, you know, with your 9-year-old?
Absolutely. He's not that curious about wanting screens. He's, you know, our strategy has been not give him video games so that he's bad at video games, then they're not fun for him, unlike his peers. So that's been our strategy. Now he's not good at video games, so he doesn't like them. His friends are all more advanced. So that has helped. But he, you know, both of them are, you know, they get, you know, 20 minutes a day. They get their show. They get 3 Blueys or, you know, one or two other shows that they watch, you know, 20, 30 minutes and some movies on the weekends. Neither of them are that into games. So some of it's luck, I want to say, you know, again, like, and some of it's parenting. But,
and what about,
you know,
what about think, phones yeah. then? Because this is the big discussion yeah. right here. It's, you know, when do you give your child their own iPhone, you know, for communication with parents or communication with peers, the social media? Right. We're seeing, you know, the big tech thinking about, well, I mean, it's not in their interest to do it and they probably never will. But talking about putting the age up when, you know, kids can join certain social media platforms. And it's something I'm wrestling with. I've got a 9-year-old as well who's, you know, like, oh, mum, when you get a new phone, can I have your old one? Absolutely not. You're going to yep. be getting some rubbish brick. We're going to go back to like 1999 and dig up my 3210 and it's going to work. So right. Have you thought about that yet?
Yeah, here's a StarTAC. We got my son a year ago, like a watch that just does calls and texts, and we can kind of track where he is, which we don't particularly do, but he can, you know, call us when he's done with soccer or football practice. You know, when he's out with his friends at the park, he can send us a text message, time to pick me up. And that feels like a good start at this point. Mm-hmm. I hope that we can wait till what we call high school here in the States, ninth grade, eighth or ninth grade, which is like 14 or 15. We'll see how that goes. It depends on kind of how the larger community is also. The other thing that I remember reading recently that I thought was a cool idea was when we do have extra phones, like we parents who are unfortunately addicted to our social media have, right, we graduate from our phone, But making a family phone for about a year before the kids get their own phone. So, you know, get a SIM card for that. You know, here's the family Instagram account. You know, if we want to get into social media, here's a family, you know, so the kids are then using it under supervision before it becomes their phone. But some days they can take it if they need it. Some days they can't. And I really like that idea. So my hope is that that's where we go with it. And then also things like, you know, you don't bring your phone in the bedroom, right? We charge them downstairs, like these kinds of rules as well. One thing that's exciting in the States is just a big article about this yesterday, but a school not too far from me just absolutely banned phones. And the mental health results have been phenomenal in that school. So I think they'll be getting a lot of attention. That superintendent's probably going to get a lot of calls in the next few weeks about how did you do it.
Watch this space. Yeah. My hope is that it's just not going to exist by the time I need to make a decision. It's all just going to fall apart. That's the plan. Dr. Chris Willard is with us today, speaking to us from the States. He is a Harvard Medical School faculty member. He's an author, a psychologist, a consultant, and we're going to be delving into the topic of empathy this hour. Why is it so important, especially in today's fast-paced world? Can you teach it? And an interesting study coming out talking about a loving bond between parents and their children early in life significantly increases a child's tendency to be pro-social, to be kind, to have empathy. It's a University of Cambridge study that came out recently. So what's Dr. Chris's take on that?
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Ranches Primary School, a nurturing community school and nursery committed to holistic education in the heart of Arabian Ranches too.
On today's show, we are delving into the topic of childhood empathy. A distinguished guest with many hats in the realm of mental health and education joining us live from the States now, Dr. Chris Willard. He serves as Harvard Medical School faculty. He's a psychologist, a consultant, and an author of more than 20 books. He's also a father, which I think is a really important thing to point out, because it's not just about the research, it's about what happens in our homes as well. The data means nothing until we're starting to think about the application to actual real-life children. So, Dr. Chris, let's dive right in. Why is teaching empathy to children so crucial, especially as we touched on earlier, in today's fast-paced world?
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the most important, what we call emotional intelligence skills, social intelligence skills. And we know that emotional intelligence is actually leads to more success and happiness in life than that sort of raw, what we call cognitive intelligence, you know, those sort of book smarts, right? You know, can you really interact with other people? Can you banter at the office? Can you get along with your partner, right? Can you get along with your kids? All of these skills are so important and serve us better, these soft skills, than sort of just classic intelligence.
Thank you for saying that.
Empathy is
and no, because I feel like with, you know, there's such academic pressure, and you know, Dubai is very competitive. There's such academic pressure, and yes, marks and book smarts will open an awful lot of doors, but emotional intelligence and likability will keep you in the room for a much, much longer. It truly will.
Right.
I think there's a really interesting study around body language that I was reading about recently, which was talking about popular kids, you know, what makes children popular. And immediately you think about those kind of high school movies about being, you know, good looking or, you know, sporty or, you know, even super, super smart. And what it found was the chances of being liked depends on how many people you like. And if you navigate those school halls and, you know, make eye contact and greet people by name and say like, you know, hey, Chris, you know, I'll see you later in this, or, you know, love your shirt, or, you know, whatever that might be. And that likability factor is so, so often undervalued. And it's not about being insincere. It's about liking people genuinely and looking for the positive in people. And then people, you know, reflect it back to you. And I think empathy is really at the crux of an awful lot of recognizing when someone maybe isn't doing so well. And sorry, I interrupted you. Tell me.
No, absolutely. And so, you know, being empathic, being an empathic leader, an empathic peer, an empathic friend, you know, an empathic teammate, right, whatever it might be, makes such a huge difference. It actually lowers our stress. It opens up our brain to actually learn more, you know, so these are some positives, as well as just, you know, of course, being a nice person is a good thing to be, but there are literally practical benefits as well in terms of our health, our physical health, our mental health, our heart health, our ability to fall asleep, which we want our kids to do night after night, right? These things actually, you know, empathy, compassion, they actually change our health, they change our mental health, they change our ability to learn, and they change the whole community, right? Getting out of the sort of more toxic, you know, academic environments and work environments that too many of our kids are in or grow up to go into. And we can teach empathy is what's actually very cool. And it's not that hard to do. It's really simple things like, you know, when we're reading, if we've got little kids, if we're reading them a picture book, it's holding up the picture book and pointing to the characters every so often and saying, what do you think that character is feeling? And when we do that, what actually happens if you do that when kids are 3 or 4, by the time they're in primary, we see them sharing more with peers. We see them checking in more with peers, right? That kind of thing makes an enormous difference as they get older, right? Asking them to read first person narratives of people who've been through difficult experiences, to write first person narratives of someone that's been through a difficult time, that promotes and provokes more empathy. So reading and writing are wonderful for this. Learning more emotions than just mad, glad, and sad, right? Which every, you know, little kid kind of knows. But it's actually true that the more words we have for emotions, which in the English language, we actually have the biggest language in the world, right? 120,000 words compared to 30,000 in other languages. The more words we have for emotions, the more well-regulated we are, the more we can recognize them in others, the more empathic we are, and then the more we can help someone who needs a little bit of help. Like you said, identify, oh, my friend says that they're happy, but their tone of voice maybe is saying that they're not, or their body language is suggesting that they're not. And so all of these things actually really help cultivate empathy. Playing games, even, I think a lot, you know, in recent years, you know, there's been such an emphasis on, you know, learning loss. And again, you're there with Seesaw again. Everyone's, you know, every parent's flashback to the pandemic. But, you know, it's like, oh, we got to catch up on math. And like, the reality is, we've got calculators for math. We got to catch up on, you know, facts and figures. Well, you know, you can Google when the War of 1812 was, right? We got to, you know, teach writing, and we do need to teach these things. And we also do have ChatGPT, which is a whole other conversation to write papers, which I'm not saying kids should write papers, but what kids aren't getting are these lessons in empathy and playing games, playing a game like, oh my gosh, 20 questions or I Spy, right? I don't know if these are games there, but it's these sort of guessing games. That's actually teaching kids, can I get into mom or dad's head, right? We did an animal last week. It'll be a vegetable this week. Dad's favorite color is orange. He picked something bigger than a microwave last time. It'll be smaller this time. Is it the carrot? Is it the basketball, right? That's actually teaching what we call cognitive empathy, which is helping kids understand what's in someone else's head. And it's something that we know so many kids lack. And one of the reasons they lack it is not because they're bad kids or they're jerks or, you know, or something like that. It's often they just don't have the practice. Mm-hmm. So Helen, I think what's cool is just practicing this stuff, you know, giving kids an experience of practicing it, which is a little bit about getting off screens too. Screens, again, aren't bad.
Well,
it's what are they getting in the way of?
That's exactly what I'm going to come to next. Dr. Chris Willard is with us today. Dr. Chris, are you happy to take some questions? We've got some coming in on the text line for you. Would that be okay?
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
So if you want to get in touch and talk anything to do with empathy, whether it's, well, we've had messages about children's empathy. We've also had a message here, anonymous, saying, no name please, but my wife grew up in a tough home, not much care or affection. It worries me that she's not affectionate with our children or comforts them when they're upset. Will this lead to our children not recognizing when someone is in need or being able to empathize? We're going to come to that. We've also had a message about, conversely, how about kids who are super sensitive? If we've got time, we'll definitely get to that. And any books on kindness to recommend as well. So lots of questions for Dr. Chris Willard, who's speaking to us from the States. I've got no idea what time it is, but I'm grateful for his time, whatever it says on the clock.
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Ranches Primary School, a nurturing community school and nursery committed to holistic education in the heart of Arabian Ranches too.
We're talking empathy today, and I'm going to look at that in the classroom, actually. So I've had a message about bullying that I'm going to save for our educators after 4. But joining us now is Dr. Chris Willard. Speaking to us from the States, he is Harvard Medical School faculty, a psychologist, an author, consultant, dad. And I wanted to go to the text line, some really interesting messages coming in for you, Dr. Chris. this one here is not necessarily concerned about children as such, but it's a husband who's been in touch saying anonymous, which is fine. You can get in touch and ask for that and say no name. That's no problem. Saying, my wife grew up in a tough home, not much care or affection, and it worries me that she's not that affectionate with our kids or comforts them easily when they're upset. Will this lead to them not recognizing when someone is in need or being able to empathize? So empathy is in terms of modeling behavior. What would you say to this listener?
Absolutely. This is a hard position to be in. One of the things I know about the Gulf, especially Emirates, is that there are so many different cultures coming together. And so that can be a challenge in intercultural marriages and families, sort of the ways, you know, in a sense, what people's love languages are and how that plays out across cultures can be a challenge. So I know, I don't know if that's this listener's particular situation, but I know that's probably true for a lot of people in the region. And so kind of educating each other about each other's cultural backgrounds and families of origin and how you did console your children, comfort your children is important, and just being proactive and thinking about that. To answer your question, are your kids gonna, you know, forever need therapy or, you know, struggle with empathy themselves? The answer is no. I think, in fact, I firmly believe that as long as kids are getting some good modeling, the kind of phrase that we use in therapy, going back about 80 years to a guy named Winnicott, is you just need one good enough parent, right? Don't have to be perfect, and no parent is.
Oh, and that it's is such a relief, such a comfort. Right? Like,
it is, right? When so many of us are like, oh my gosh, you know, like, what are the therapy bills going to be today after I yelled at my kid?
No, it's interesting, you know,
and I've doomed them to a life of this or that.
I think I think that is a huge sense of relief, because no, I honestly do. It's one of the things that me and my husband kind of fall out about the most, is how different our parenting styles are and how sometimes we clash and sometimes we complement. But the fact we both care, I think, you know, obviously helps. So you just need one good enough parent. I mean, can that be the title of my memoir? I think that sounds fantastic.
I love it. I mean, I was just thinking, someone's got to write a book with that. How has no one written that title book yet?
Totally.
I think there you go, Helen. There's the next one. No, good enough.
God, give me a break, Dr. Chris. I needed to ask you about mindfulness, if that's okay, because this is something that is a real kind of feather in your cap and a real area of passion for you. You know, you talk about this in a kind of, I'm going to have to say this very carefully, emphasize mindfulness as a tool for promoting empathy. So how do you feel like some mindfulness practice can help children develop a greater understanding of their own emotions, but also others and perspective as well? Can you kind of unpack that for us a little bit?
Absolutely. So it's learning to, I mean, a lot of mindfulness is learning to recognize our own emotions and validate ourselves, is what self-compassion is, when no one else is around to validate us. And as parents, but the best thing we can do to be empathic to our kids and model it is to validate their emotions, right? And this is also what I do is, I mean, the joke, of course, of the therapist, they sit in the office and they say, oh, it sounds like you're feeling angry at your mother, who is not good enough. Her name is Helen. No,
hey.
It sounds, right, whatever it might be, right? Or it sounds like you're feeling sad, or it sounds like, what we're actually doing when we do that is we're naming the emotion. And when you name an emotion that you're feeling or someone else is feeling, is you actually can put people in an MRI machine, like a brain scanner, and you show them different emotions and you watch actually blood flow into the emotional part of the brain, and we feel the emotion strongly, it starts to take over. And then when we name the emotion, you actually watch the blood flow into the other parts of the brain, the empathy parts of the brain, the self-regulation, the decision-making parts of the brain, the action parts of the brain, and it settles down. So this is why we say to our kids, use your words, right? I say that like 20 times a day to my daughter when she's screaming, right? Or, you know, this is why as therapists we say, sounds like you're feeling this or that, or we say to our kids, sounds like you're feeling sad about this or angry about that. And what that actually does is it helps the child to then settle down. And so just by kind of learning, you know, through mindfulness, oh, this is what sadness feels like. And maybe it's doing something like listening to some different music, like with your kids or in a classroom. I listen to sad music and happy music and angry music and notice how your body feels with each of those songs. And then you're actually teaching kids to recognize their emotions, right? Maybe starting with the basic palette of mad, glad, sad. And then the more they recognize it, the more they can manage it. So it's sort of like a, you know, mindful music listening exercise, or just naming emotions as you feel them. All of these kinds of mindfulness practices really help us to regulate our emotions and recognize them in ourselves and then also learn to recognize them in other people. And so that then builds more empathy as well. And that builds, you know, kind of how we manage the difficult emotion, whether it's in ourselves or, oh, my friend needs maybe not for me to talk or problem solve, but just a hand on their back, or just to, you know, let them know I'm here for them. Or I can ask them, do you want advice now? Or do you want, you know, me just to listen to you right now? Or do you want me to vent with you? And so that actually helps us with mindfulness to see what's going to be the most helpful thing that we can do in that moment, as well as just recognizing our emotions too and other people's emotions.
Dr. Chris Willard is with us today. And we've had a message from Kaz saying, how about showing ourselves some empathy and compassion in front of our kids? Mm. That's an interesting point.
Yeah.
Especially now, as we talk about the struggles of distance learning and how parents are pulling their hair out. Self-compassion, people.
Yes, my dear, we all hate seesaw. I think it is so important, actually, to show our kid. One of the things I think that comes up a lot is people get very worried about showing anxiety or conflict or emotions in front of their kids. And then we get mixed messages. No, you should show emotions in front of your kids. The key is, if you show anxiety in front of your kids, to try to also show your kids, oh, this is how I manage my anxiety. If you snap at your partner in front of your kids, then you should also apologize to your partner in front of your kids, which can be really hard to do. And I've had to do that sometimes, right? We have to kind of swallow our pride. So I think, and then also saying, like, this is a hard moment for me. You know, I'm gonna, you know, put a hand on my heart, give myself a hug, take a few breaths. You know, I'm feeling stressed about work. I'm going to, you know, give myself, you know, do something kind for myself right now, or take a break. I think this traffic is really frustrating today. Mm-hmm. You know, let's take a few breaths while we're stuck in traffic here, or let's sing a song, or let's do something that we love that shifts how we feel a little bit, or notice something beautiful around us. So I think the more we can model, I think, our strong emotions, our big emotions, even our difficult emotions, and we can model what we do to manage them and not let them take over. And that's one of the best lessons for kids. Again, kids learn by watching us, not by us saying, go focus on your breath, right? And yelling at them to do that. It's by us saying, I'm stressed out.
Yeah, 'cause that
I'm
going to
focus on my breath.
Okay. Dr. Chris, I've got a few messages and we've got about 10 minutes of chat time left. So if you do have a message for or a question for Dr. Chris Willard, please do get in touch sooner rather than later. Anonymous message again, which is absolutely fine, saying, long story short, my eldest child is incredibly kind and thoughtful, and I never have to worry about how they treat other children. But the youngest child, 7 years old, I see has the capacity to be unkind. Everything comes easily to them. They're top of the class, sporty, popular. But I worry that the youngest runs rings around other kids, and there have been some examples where they've just been not so nice to children. Also lies very easily. I come down on a ton of bricks when I see these examples, but I'm wondering, is it a personality type, or could some of your techniques teach some kindness and empathy? Interesting.
Absolutely.
About personality there.
Yeah, yeah. And personality kind of does develop at a young age. I always remind parents, you know, you probably don't have a budding psychopath on your hands if they're not telling the truth or not always being so kind. We don't want to worry about that yet. In fact, it sounds like you've got a very smart kid, you know, if they're achieving so well in school. And actually, one of the funny things about dishonesty is, actually, dishonesty is a sign of intelligence in kids, because they're getting their needs met. We don't want them to do it, but it actually is a sign of developmentally that they're often ahead of the game. If they're doing it a lot in later years, at this age, it's relatively, it is what it is. But in later years, we start to worry about it. The thing about lying is actually, you know, there's been some studies about this. You know, punishing too hard actually just gets kids to be better liars. Like, some of us might remember being, you know, teenagers and sneaking out and getting into shenanigans, right? Our parents came down on us. We just got to be sneakier. And
oh,
so what we really want to do is...
So devious. But the bright side is the kids will be able to get very, very, very little past me, because I've done it all.
Exactly. I feel like I'm like ready for adolescence, given mine. I'm like, I know all the hiding spots. But like creating a space where they feel comfortable coming to us and saying, you know what, I did take the cookie out of the cookie jar, right? Saying, you know, I won't be mad at you. You know, I just want to know what happened. And that actually really sends a different message. You know, one interesting study, was looking at like, you know, different stories to tell kids, like The Boy Who Cried Wolf and, you know, Pinocchio. And then we have this kind of folktale in the U.S. about George Washington, you know, cut down his father's cherry tree, and he confessed to his father and said, I'm sorry, Dad, I cut down the cherry tree. When his dad said, what happened to the cherry tree? And actually, when you tell that story to kids, kids are less likely to lie. If you tell Pinocchio or if you tell The Boy Who Cried Wolf, they're actually more likely to lie. So it's this really surprising thing where we just want to see what's underneath the dishonest behavior, right? What needs are they trying to get? How can they get that same need met in some other way? You know, and maybe this child's, you know, struggles, you know, unlike their sibling, they struggle socially, but not academically. And so they're kind of, you know, clumsily, you know, by bullying and not so kind behavior, trying to get their social needs met. And it's learning some new skills of soft skills and catching more flies with honey than vinegar and that kind of thing.
Thank you for that. I hope that's reassuring to our mystery listener. So you don't need to worry, because I think that is the concern, isn't it? When you see a child, you know, pulling the wings off a fly, like, oh, there goes a future psychopath. But digging a bit deeper. Joining us live on the line from the US is Dr. Chris Willard. He is an author. He is a psychologist, a consultant. He's faculty at Harvard Medical School as well. And he's a dad. And we're talking empathy today. We're going to be exploring it in the classroom because I've had a couple of questions about bullying, and I'm curious how schools handle that. But we've just been talking about some strategies about teaching, encouraging kindness and empathy in our children. You know, everything from, you know, playing games to naming feelings to reading books and asking children to think, you know, what do you think that character's feeling? What are they going through right now? Would you mind a few book recommendations? We've had a message here from Abby saying, love this. Any books on kindness to recommend? Anything come to mind, Chris?
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of really lousy books on kindness and mindfulness in these topics. I want to say, I get, you know, people always send me books in the mail, check out my book, and my kids are often like, oh, is that one of those kindness or mindfulness books?
Kids are the critics.
You know, the obvious ones from a mile away. But there's some classics that I really love. I mean, I think about like Ferdinand, I think, you know, The Bull, I think about, you know, books about friendship, like Frog and Toad is really deep. It's about, you know, like a friend, you know, really caring for their troubled and depressed friend with empathy. I think my daughter's name is May, and someone gave us a book called May's First Day of School. And it's actually a wonderful book about a teacher and a student kind of sharing empathy with each other about being both nervous. It's both of their first days of school. So those are a few great ones.
All right. I love it. Love a recommendation. Thank you. Great question. Great answer. We've been talking about empathy today, but we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I want to put this to you. This is a message here saying, what about kids who are super sensitive? I've got an 8-year-old boy. It's impacting friendships, even family interactions. He can't take even a gentle joke from loved ones. He tantrums, cries easily. Just last night, we were all laughing at the children's baby photos. I've got 3 kids, and he stormed out after kicking his chair over. We're working with a play therapist who suggested modelling gentle teasing to help show him that people can playfully tease each other, and it's not a form of attack. But I'd really welcome Dr. Chris's advice. You've got about a minute. Doctor, would you mind offering some insight to this concerned parents?
Well, I'm wondering did I write in about my own son?
Oh, really?
I think like it's figuring out how to turn the sensitivity into a superpower. I mean, this is very much the kind of kid I was, you know, cried very easily, very sensitive about so many things, very self-conscious. It's learning how to help that child kind of be, you know, embrace who they are and turn that into empathy later in life for others, that deep kind of sense of sensitivity that they have, you know, with the world can be, you know, turned into an amazing force for good, for understanding the pain that other people feel. But it's also then giving them a little bit more resilience. And as the play therapist suggested, there is a little bit of like talking about what's the purpose of teasing, like the right kind of teasing actually does you know, in a sense, toughen us up. That doesn't mean, you know, throw our kids to the wolves or anything like that. But talking about, you know, this is a joke, this is about loving you, and this is, you know, laughing together and not laughing at you, those kinds of conversations. And some of it's developmental. It just takes kids a little bit of time to see other people's perspective and see what's behind the behavior. And then there's also, you know, really ill-intentioned, you know, nasty bullying that goes on too. And that's what we want to, you know, then we might want to work with the school and work with our child too to figure out how to, like, literally stand up for themselves and push back on that in different ways and not run out of the room, because that actually only often, unfortunately, increases the bullying, is the ways that kids respond to it. So presenting themselves sometimes in a different way can make a big difference. And that is things like posture, tone of voice, acting a bit more confident. It's a shame that we have to teach the kid getting bullied, in the sense, how to not get bullied, but it actually does work.
Good to know.
Ironically.
My final question to you is, when is the book coming out? We you've written 20 now, and I know you're working with a friend on the brilliantly titled Feelings Are Like Farts, because as we spoke about last time, you shouldn't blame them on other people, and it's really unhealthy to keep them in. When is the book coming out?
If you hold them in for too long, they can end up really exploding. So, you know, you don't want to have them in an elevator, on the airplane. So we wrote this book like 3 years ago during the pandemic over text message in about 20 minutes. Changed publishers along the way and had some delays. The cover will be out. Actually, I think any day now, the cover should be popping up on Amazon. We just got the illustrations back. They're making a few more tweaks to the illustrations, and hopefully that'll be out soon, and hopefully it'll be out worldwide, and I'll be back in Dubai to sign some copies at some point.
I hope so. Thank you so much for your time today.
Really,
really appreciate it. An absolute pleasure, and we'll catch up with you very soon indeed.
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Ranches Primary School, a nurturing community school and nursery committed to holistic education in the heart of Arabian Ranches too.
Helen Farmer with you for Eye on Education, and chatting now with Hayley Lamb, the Vice Principal at Ranches Primary School. We are talking about empathy, how it's taught in the curriculum, in the classroom, that, you know, even in the counsellor's office after 8:30 as well. But before we talk about that, Hayley Lamb, how is distance learning going from the teacher side, you absolute legends? How are you getting on?
I knew this was coming. Yeah, good. We at Ranches Primary are super organised. We reflected upon the distance learning the other week. So we asked all of our teachers to give feedback about how it was for them and any feedback that they'd received from parents. And then we had sort of an action meeting yesterday where all of heads of year and heads of subject were involved, so that we can just ensure that we can do the best by the children, but also obviously look after the well-being of our staff members as well.
We've got another day of it, although half a day, it's a Friday, so it's not too bad. What are some of the assurances that you're offering parents about, I guess, your expectations as a teacher? You know, we might have parents who are working from home who are juggling multiple children and their job, or perhaps they're in the office and they're having to hand over responsibilities to, you know, a helper at home. I guess I'm really asking you, saying, we're not expecting perfection, are we?
Not at all. Now, most definitely is not the time for perfectionism or anything like that. All I would say is remove the word should out of your mind as parents. So, you know, I should be sitting with my child doing this, and I should get through the big list. And just look at what you can do. So I'm a parent of two boys. However, I already had a full schedule of interviews today. So unfortunately, I've not been able to sit with the boys. And so I'm not actually sure what they've submitted today. And that's fine, because they're happy and they're okay. And they've just been out on their bike.
Oh, thank you.
And my youngest did have a meltdown this morning at the thought of all of the tasks. However, some families maybe have got more time or more flexibility, or their children maybe work at a quicker rate. And so we as a school put plenty of things on there so that the children can make a choice. So as an example, with my youngest, we did eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and put all the tasks on a post-it note and went round and chose one. He wasn't that happy when English came out. So we had to do it, the rhyme again. All I would say is just remove the word should.
Oh,
and again, all of the schools aren't expecting everybody to submit everything that's been given. It's very much a whatever you can do.
Well, Arabic was very firmly given the elbow from my two today, and they've been playing games, although they did just say that the Wi-Fi's been turned off. So I think there have been, not turned off, it's come off. So hopefully that's back on. But yeah, thank you genuinely as a parent for understanding some of the pressures. And again, shout out to the teachers who are navigating, you know, quickly changing circumstances. And as you're saying there, Hayley, having, you know, kids of your own to have in the equation as well, which actually brings us very neatly onto our topic of today, which is about empathy. We were speaking there to Dr. Chris Willard, discussing some strategies that you can do at home. But I'm curious because I don't even think many people really understand the full meaning of the word empathy, never mind imagine that it's taught in school in various capacities. Would you mind explaining kind of what it means to you, and I guess how it is taught in schools, even at different age groups as well, in terms of emotional understanding and language, Hayley?
Yeah, so empathy and the teaching of it starts at such a young age. So the early years curriculum, which goes from 6 months all the way up to 5 years, has 7 areas. And one of those areas of learning is actually PSED, which stands for personal, social, emotional development. So within this is where children start to form friendships, learn about empathy, learn about what's right and wrong, about your choices. So it really does start at an early, early age. And then going through to sort of year one upwards, the children have PSHE lessons. In Dubai, we have moral, social, cultural studies, where the children are given opportunities to reflect on situations, maybe given posed questions about what would you do in this situation. Storybooks are used. So I've got a storybook here, which is called Empathy is Your Superpower. Another book called You, Me and Empathy. And these are just two that I've grabbed out of my bookshelf. And teachers will use these as stimulus for conversations, maybe for circle time activities. We are very sort of proactive, but also we have to be reactive. So if mm-hmm. a situation comes up in the class, then we might do a circle time or use a book as a stimulus. Assemblies are linked to sort of different areas, but empathy is definitely one of those. So at Ranchi's Primary, we have our character compass, and one of our animals is Etty the... Well, it's the 6 C's. So one of our, they're like learning skills. They're skills that we think every child should be able to sort of take with them for their lifelong learning. And one of the 6 C's is compassion. And obviously mm-hmm. compassion links really well with empathy. And so Etty the elephant is our compassion character, who, and the children were taught a story about Etty. And then in assemblies, we will give certificates out for anybody who is showing Etty elephant traits and being compassionate. So even when I was prepping for this interview, I was thinking, right, I'm going to do an empathy assembly, because it's Etty's turn in a couple of weeks' time. So each animal has a weekly focus, so it runs every 6 weeks. And I know other schools out there are doing similar things as well. You know, everyone's got their unique sort of unique angle that they're coming at it from. But empathy is, like I say, especially in the UIFS curriculum, it is part of PSED. So all I would say is, especially to parents, don't assume that your children know what empathy is, mm-hmm. Because we have to model it. Like, I've seen my youngest, he's getting a lot of mentions today, and my eldest, I've seen how they are with younger children, or if a younger child hurts themselves, and basically they copy what I would do if they've hurt themselves, or they'll go and say things to some people, and I think, gosh, where have they had that from? And then I stop and I think, oh, that's me. It's like me talking. And I've never actually sat down and taught them that. I would say, you know, be mindful that your children are watching you. Yeah, most definitely.
This isn't something I'd planned to ask you, so apologies. How can we get... Because as I mentioned earlier, we had some pinching at the dinner table last night. One daughter said to the other something that annoyed her. Her sister retaliated by giving it a pretty serious pinch on the arm. There seems to be no empathy between siblings in our household. Like, there's no, oh gosh, she might, you know, shall I offer her a glass of water? Or, you know, she seems a bit nervous about school today. They don't care less about that at all. And I don't know if that's something that you can help me with. As a mum and a teacher, Hayley?
So I think my children are very similar age difference to yours. Mm. So I've got two boys, you've got two girls. Mine definitely love each other probably 90% of the time, and then 10% of the time sort of show similar traits.
You're doing great.
Just sitting them down and turning it into a bit of a social story. So, you know, how do you think so-and-so felt when you did that? You know, would they do that to you? How would you feel if somebody did that to you? Sometimes it's a lot easier if you talk about the situation with characters, so you don't necessarily use your own children, because we all sometimes find it struggle to talk about ourselves. Yeah. So as an example, if they were into Paw Patrol, you might use two Paw Patrol characters and you might say, how does Chase feel when Skye does this to them, sort of thing? And obviously link it to their age and what they're into. Because actually, if you don't stop them, then they're just going to carry on, because they're not going to actually reflect. And actually reflecting on our behaviours and our actions is a real good life skill to have. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I don't think I probably started reflecting on anything until I was about 20. And now I reflect on everything. Maybe I overthink things too much. But I think, you know, children need to be curious about the situation, and you can do that through stories, so you can really get them thinking about, oh, actually, you know, what Skye did to Chase wasn't very nice, and actually you can avoid talking about what they did to somebody else, but most definitely address it and link it to those sort of key questions to really get them thinking on a deeper level.
Hayley Lamb is with us today. Thank you for that. I do appreciate it. Vice Principal at Ranchers Primary School, keeping with her. I want to know a little bit more about that curriculum. And also, you know, are teachers trained now, you know, to support and model empathy in the classroom? Plus, we've had this message earlier that came in for Dr. Chris, but I've saved it for now because it's more related to schools, saying our son is six, was mistreated by a boy earlier last year, pushed, you know, teased and pulled. He's had a bruise recently. They're boisterous boys. They're 6 years old. I've spoken to a teacher and I felt like it was minimised. I'm starting to think that schools can actually do very little. Kids can be really rough, lack empathy, and they seem to love the smaller, quieter kids. So what role do schools play, I guess, is the question there, in identifying a situation and what happens next?
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Ranchers Primary School, a nurturing community school and nursery committed to holistic education in the heart of Arabian Ranchers too.
Hayley Lamb is with us today, the Vice Principal at Ranchers Primary School, as we talk about the importance of teaching empathy to kids. Touching there on a couple of really lovely book recommendations, Hayley, as well, and some of the characters that embody the feelings that we want our children to be able to name and recognise. I love this idea of an elephant being all about empathy. Can I ask about teachers and training and how they understand how to effectively teach and model empathy in the classroom? Because I feel like we've always had this idea of that lovely Miss Honey teachers, and that wasn't really my experience growing up at school, you know, 30 years ago. However, when I meet the teachers that my children have now, it is absolutely light years difference in terms of, you know, eye level and coming down to a child's level and listening and well-being and mental health being taught. So why is that such a priority, and what does that actually look like when it comes to training teachers in empathy and emotional intelligence?
I think it's really important that we expose teachers to sort of professional learning, because we can't assume that every teacher has come from the same background. So there's an example at Ranchers Primary, when we are recruiting for our teachers, the character of a person is actually at the centre of what we're looking for. So we always call it like a Ranchers teacher, but very much at the centre of that is somebody who has that holistic approach where well-being comes first, and looking at educating the whole child and understanding and believing in it as well. Now, don't get me wrong, I have come across teachers in my time who maybe don't show signs of empathy and that kind of thing. Unfortunately, the teaching practice has definitely changed over time. The teaching standards don't actually include empathy as one of the areas you would have to be trained in. It's very much like what I would say is teaching attracts a certain type of person, And it's our jobs as sort of school leaders to ensure that we're up to date with sort of expectations and what we need for the region. So well-being is really high on sort of the Dubai's agenda, most definitely. Like, we're inspected in well-being when they come in and look at our schools, and so, and rightly so. So actually we have to provide our staff members with the tools. And firstly, the way we do that is by modelling it. So we are very empathetic with our staff, and in turn our staff sort of model that trait back to the children as well. And you know, it's definitely on our horizon to be a little bit more explicit with our professional learning opportunities moving forward. Across the whole Cognita group, actually, we're looking at sort of linking our professional learning opportunities across schools. So if somebody's an expert in a particular area, so as an example, I'm a professional coach as well as an educator, so I said, well, I can do that side of things. You know, I could offer that professional learning to the other schools as well. But yeah, it's high on our agenda. So as an example, we are looking for sort of somebody to join our wellbeing team full time next academic year. And a big part of their job would be this sort of empathy role and supporting the students pastorally on top of what the class teachers are already doing. But our class teachers are supported heavily by our SLT if they need it. Some people need more than others. You know, they really do. Some people maybe have been on their own journeys and so have learned empathy on the job, so to speak, or you know, have had lots of experience of having to show empathy and be empathetic, and some people not so much. But we're very much an open door policy where people can come and ask for help and advice.
I wanted to come to the text line, Hayley, because this message came in earlier for Dr. Chris Willard, and it was asking, what role do schools play? So here we are with you, Vice Principal, saying, our son is six, was mistreated by a boy, pushed, pulled, teased at school last year. Now he's got a bruise occasionally, sometimes linked to two boys in his new class. They're very boisterous. From what I hear, they do hurt a lot of kids. I spoke to the teacher about one specific incident, but I felt it was very quickly minimised. I'm starting to think the school can actually do very little, and perhaps that's not their fault. These kids are just really rough and they lack empathy, and they seem to love the smaller, quieter kids like my boy and target them. So we talked earlier about, you know, teaching and fostering empathy, but what role do schools play in identifying children that might need a bit more of a helping hand in this, and then facilitating, whether it's, you know, conversations with parents or with, you know, victims of bullying, to really help everybody involved?
So every school will have its own behaviour policy and bullying policy. And so obviously I can't speak on behalf of other schools, but I can tell you what we would do at Ranchies as an example, if that was sort of a situation arose like that. So we would take all concerns very seriously. We would fully investigate. We would discuss with the students involved to see, you know, from the students' perspective, because sometimes parents can get a totally different perspective as well at home. So it's important to chat with the children and the other children in the class. And if we deem that this has happened, then it's about supporting everybody involved, because sometimes it might be a reason why your child is behaving in a certain way. And obviously, so each child would receive the support they need to be able to move forward from a situation. And we would do that either with the class teacher, and they would use, isn't it, like I said earlier, like stories as an example, sort of social stories, or we would use a storybook, or if they're older, we would have an open and honest conversation with them and ask them some key questions to really get them thinking. It just needs to be given time. You can't dismiss somebody's concerns. We always say every concern is a valid concern, and we totally appreciate that we have people's babies with us, you know, like the love of their life, their bundle of joy. And so as schools, we want to we want the parents to feel heard, and it's really important that, you know, children are happy coming to school. So it breaks our hearts if we thought that somebody wasn't happy coming to school. So like I say, I can't speak on behalf of other schools, but yeah, each school would have their own behaviour policy, so that's probably a good place to start.
Well, thank you for your time today. As I said, I know it's been a bit of an unusual one with distance learning, and you're going to be in the studio, but weren't sure what the roads were going to be doing, although I have to say, it's not so bad out there. Hey, Lam, really appreciate your time. Get back to I would say, your kids. You got lots of kids. Your own kids, you've got the school kids. Hayley Lam is the vice principal at Ranchers Primary School.
This is Eye on Education on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
With Ranchers Primary School, a nurturing community school and nursery committed to holistic education in the heart of Arabian Ranches too.
It is Distance Learning Day today and tomorrow, so I'm especially grateful for the time that our educators are able to give to us today. And joining us now is the school counsellor at Horizon International School, Coral Leach. We are exploring the topic of empathy today, but of course we have to talk about distance learning and what is going on. Coral, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. I mean, I'm not going to lie, I'm relieved to be here and not at home navigating Seesaw with my seven-year-old, because there were some tears earlier and there's been trying to keep the girls separate, and there's been, she ruined this recording for me and I don't want to do Arabic and I've got my iPad, can I just play a bit of Toca Boca or Roblox until my next Zoom? No, you can't. No, you can't, because you don't normally have an iPad at 10 o'clock on a Thursday. So you've got your iPad for work and then it's going away. The struggle is real, Coral. The struggle is real.
It definitely is. I feel for you there. Talking about empathy, I really empathise with you in that situation.
Thank you. Nice segue. I appreciate that. But actually, before we get on to empathy, because I want to get your take, actually, because the distance learning, I mean, I've got younger kids. They're 7 and 9. A couple of days or a day and a half, even, because it's Friday, is not the end of the world. But for older kids, I did immediately think, and I've got a friend who's head of secondary at a school here in Dubai, there's exams going on right now. So, yeah. You know, you as a school counsellor, when you are looking after especially those older children about their next steps, what does that actually mean? What's been happening in that space?
It's definitely a challenge, and it's obviously one that we couldn't have predicted. I think the teachers, the students are absolute credit to themselves in terms of the dedication that they're putting towards it and how they're really powering ahead. Teachers are putting in extra time, students are really committing to it. So I'd say that overall, I think they're really adapting well to such a tricky situation. And it's just supporting students to manage that extra bit of stress that, of course, we didn't anticipate in terms of not having as much time face-to-face in school to call on your teachers. Yeah. But as I say, teachers are really dedicating their time and their commitment over towards students to make sure that they're still prepared, they've got everything they need. So we're hoping it shouldn't affect anything too badly. Students are doing a great job at powering through.
It has been a kind of a disruptive time, I think, in terms of routine and learning. You know, obviously had Ramadan hours and then it was Eid and then we came back and we had floods and then the, you know, these 2 days. So as you say, it's been really, really challenging for teachers, definitely, for students, absolutely, and parents trying to, you know, emotionally regulate what is a very, very stressful time with some other variables thrown into the mix. So yeah, a credit to you all. Coral, I want to understand, what does a school counsellor do? Would you mind explaining a little bit about, I don't want to say a typical day because I'm sure you haven't got one, but some of, you know, your favourite things about the job and the key roles and responsibilities, especially obviously given your space at Horizon International?
Yeah, definitely. So there's usually kind of two different types of school counsellors that you can get. So you can get school counsellors that are more guidance based, which is more down that career prospect, university, down that kind of route. And you can get counsellors that are more emotional based. So that is more so where I fall in it. Of course, I do a little bit of the both. But the most of my role kind of falls in emotional well-being, social well-being. So within my role, I run one-to-one school counselling sessions with children that struggle with different emotional or social difficulties. I run resilience groups with various year groups throughout the school. And then alongside that, I support with the whole school well-being. So everything that we do as a whole to support children, raise awareness, our awareness week, things like neurodiversity week, children's mental health week. So I assist with all the runnings of those too. So it's a little bit of everything. And of course, being the school counsellor also means that I have to consider our staff. So I'm always there for our staff and our teachers as well.
That is a lot. You must be taking on a lot as well. And I ask this to psychologists quite a bit in terms of, you know, how do you protect your own energy? You know, how do you not get, you know, caught up in some of the trickier moments and trickier conversations? Is that something you're quite conscious of?
Yeah, definitely. I think you always have to be when you're dealing with people that are really struggling emotionally, especially within a school. I kind of never know what I'm going to get. You never know what somebody's going to walk through the door with. You never know what they've experienced before. And especially working in an international school, we have so many different nationalities. We have so many children with so many different backgrounds and experiences that are really tricky and are really hard. And sometimes it can be really hard to listen to what people have been through. But I'm really passionate about being able to try and make a change and support. I've worked with children and I've worked with adults. And I find that with children, I'm really here to try and make a difference so that then when they are an adult, things are maybe a little bit easier for them. So that rewarding side of the role really, I guess, keeps me going. But you're right in terms of protecting your energy and managing what comes through the door. I think it really focuses on looking after my own well-being, making sure I take that time out for myself, trying to keep that work-life balance wherever you can, so that it becomes manageable and you can show up to work with that full sense of being ready for Yeah, having a full capability to be able to be compassionate towards the students that need them.
Can you imagine if you were a massive hypocrite and you were like always absolutely knackered and really stressed and telling people how to work on their own well-being? So, well said. Good to hear. When you're talking about what's coming through the door, Carl, what is coming through the door? What are some of the common challenges, you know, certainly emotional, that are facing Dubai students today?
Completely varies, really. So I'd say more so with the younger children, it's more kind of trying to understand their emotions. So it's more where they have been kind of maybe taken off guard, or they're overwhelmed quite a lot, or sometimes difficulties with anger. And it's just purely on the basis of they don't really know how to manage it. I don't really know what this is. I just know that I feel this way and I need to get it out. So with younger children, I'd say it's a lot more of kind of just being overwhelmed in so many different situations and not knowing how to deal with it. With older students, we have a lot more, of course, friendship difficulties as our teenagers grow up and try and socialise in different circles, try and figure out who they are in the world, what they want from life, where they fit. It's a really tricky time. So we have a lot of difficulties come around that aspect. But then we also do get the stresses of exams and finding routines and worrying about futures. There's a lot of kind of common themes that come through it. But I'd say overall, the key theme is that children are overwhelmed just in different experiences and different ways. But that feeling of just being overwhelmed is probably the most common thing that comes through the door.
Oh, they're not alone. I think that's a generational, goes all the way up. With coming to see the school counsellor, I was talking to my kids about it the other day because, you know, the school counsellor, I think, in most, if not all, schools right now. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of, I didn't use the word stigma because they wouldn't know what that means, but I was trying to get an understanding of, you know, do you know who to go to? And, you know, how would that feel? Would you be okay about doing that? You know, what's in place? And they were talking about, you know, you can go and see, you know, your class rep, and then they might speak to a school counsellor. Do you think there is a bit of a stigma attached to going to see someone such as yourself, and, you know, who might, a kid that might have some anger issues or might be trying to work through things on a one-off or a regular basis?
Yeah, I think it's still something that is a little bit tricky, purely because it's kind of an evolving conversation still, mental health, isn't it? And especially for children. And when we think to the children, kind of the ages that we're dealing with now and the generation of their parents, it wasn't something that was discussed. It's not something that has ever really been actively talked about. It maybe even at some points quite frowned upon. So I think we have to kind of bear that in mind when we're thinking about how children might feel about accessing a school counsellor, based on what they might know from whether it's talked about at home or whether it's still something that's quite tough to approach in the household. So I think there is still always a little bit of stigma around things that we are working through. But I would say this is the most positive I've ever seen it. Like, I really don't have any issues with children coming to my door. And because I'm regularly around school, children see me quite a lot. I pop into classes, so they kind of know who I am. I do the assemblies. So I guess me being more present in other ways, except from just the one-to-one counselling, can really support with abolishing that stigma within the school, to show that I am accessible and to normalise talking about feeling overwhelmed, feeling angry, feeling upset.
Just normalise, having someone to talk to. I mean, that is an awful lot of adults I know would just be you know, to get so much out of having someone who's impartial, who hasn't got an agenda, who's gotten, has made the time to spend and listen to you. I think it's crucial, and to have that, as you say, normalised from childhood means that hopefully they, you know, as they get older, you know, it becomes easier to talk to partners, to friends, to professionals if it's needed. I think it's absolutely crucial. Joining us live on the line, Coral Leach, the school counsellor at Horizon International School. We've just been talking about a little bit about the role and normalising some difficult conversations with kids. And our topic of the hour is empathy. And you even have an empathy week. Coral, tell us about why you're placing such importance on this soft skill. I guess it is a skill. It's something you can learn and practice. What happens and how do you approach it?
So Empathy Week is something that we've taken that is run in the UK, and it's been really successful across schools. And as you say, it is a soft skill, and we're teaching students so much throughout school. Like, I think empathy is a really big part of that, but it's maybe not something that we always kind of outline that empathy is included in. But I do think it's embedded in things that schools are already doing anyway. So kind of focusing this week is to, I guess, raise the awareness of the skill itself and what that means, and to raise a bit more of an understanding towards it. So it's gone really well so far, and we're really, really happy at how engaged the students have been with the activities and the way we ran it. So we were lucky enough to take some talks from the Empathy Week that was being run in the UK, and one of the talks that we used with our secondary students was from a young lady who experienced fibromyalgia throughout her school journey, and she talked about it after now leaving school, and talked about how it would have been a lot more helpful if people were more empathetic towards her situation. And I think as we think about how students interact, how students face different pressures within school, if empathy is a key skill that they're able to demonstrate, it will just create hopefully a bit more of a helpful environment for everybody, so that everybody can feel a little bit more comfortable and feel relaxed around the people that they spend their time with, knowing that they will be empathetic towards whatever situation they're in, whatever they're experiencing, and have people to turn to. So that's the reason that we kind of taken that focus on Empathy Week, and really pushed for drawing the awareness to the word of empathy and how we use that in itself.
We were chatting earlier with Dr. Chris Willard, who's a psychologist, amazing author as well, and he was talking about things you can do to teach empathy. And some of them were really unexpected, you know, from reading books and pointing to a character and saying, you know what to think. You know, I think they might be feeling too, naming feelings, you know, attaching, you know, appropriate emotions and words, but also playing games as well. And I wondered if there's anything that you think could be quite useful for parents to continue some of the work that's happening in the classroom. And modelling behaviour, obviously, a really, really crucial one as well, as Hayley Lam mentioned earlier. But anything else come to mind, Coral?
Yeah, so there's actually a really good board game that I use within groups within school, and it was actually created by psychologists in Dubai from the Lighthouse Arabia, and it's called the Smart Heart Game, and it is an incredible board game that is all focused on building emotionally intelligent children. One of the things I really like about the board game is that it has these kind of situation cards, and it will just be a picture of something. Usually one character is either having like a sad face or an angry face, like he's displaying some sort of an emotion. And when it's your turn, if you fall on to take one of those cards, you have to create a story about what's happening in that picture. And it really helps children to kind of use their imagination to apply it to emotions and to think about what emotion is that person feeling? What does it look like it's happening? And how would that link up to how they're feeling? So it's a really great way to build that emotional intelligence. And again, if we think about then the longevity of the skill of empathy, if you're able to understand how different emotions and different situations might connect together, it'll be a lot easier for you to be empathetic towards somebody else, and just to demonstrate empathy in a whole, not only with the compassion towards yourself, but those around you as well. I would hugely recommend the Smart Heart board game. You can buy it from the Lighthouse Arabia directly, and it's incredible to use with any children.
What a great recommendation. I'm just on the website now, smartheartboardgame.com, children aged 4 to 11. And I think it's something, as you say, as a family, you know, have start having these conversations. Thank you, Coral, for your time. Really, really appreciate it. I hope the next few days are fine for you, and it's back to normal on Monday. Wishing you a lovely weekend ahead. Coral Leach speaking to us from Horizon International School. That was Eye on Education. I'm Helen Farmer, and you can catch us live on Dubai Eye 103.8 every single Thursday afternoon.